The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and we are broadcasting from my apartment. Like everybody else, we're making adjustments. Since its outbreak last year, the coronavirus, COVID-19, has thrown the world into disarray. Travel from Europe has been restricted for 30 days at least. Financial markets have tanked. Saudi Arabia canceled the Hajj, the Islamic pilgrimage. The NBA has suspended the basketball season. And who knows what could happen to all kinds of public assemblages, theaters, the Olympics, and all the rest. And in China, where the outbreak began, nearly 800 million people have been living under some kind of restriction.
Hello? Oh, yeah, I can hear you fine.
Given all this, we rang up our staff writer, Peter Hessler, on Skype. Peter has reported for years from China. He went back with his family last year to teach at Sichuan University.
Yeah, no, we're in Chengdu, which is in the southwest. It's the capital of Sichuan province. And so, yeah, so, I mean, we've been quarantined since, January, late January. We have two nine-year-olds. We have twin daughters. They're in Chinese public school. And so the city, so my kids are not in school. And, this has been more than a month. My kids have not seen another kid their age for more than a month.
Now, here in the States, we talk about self-quarantining. That's a voluntary decision to keep others safe. But in China, a quarantine is a quarantine.
Usually in many compounds, they would allow like one person out from each household every 2 days. Because we're sort of in a higher end thing, there was no limit. We have to have a card to go in and out, but we can go in and out as much as we want. And so I went out a lot, and because I would bike around and see what's going on in the city. And, there's more people out. There was a long stretch when there was absolutely nobody on the street. And there wasn't much open, but convenience stores were always open. Kind of like small markets were always open. People, at least around here, didn't have problems with food because a lot of people do stuff online anyway here. And so I've kind of tracked what my neighbors are like, the weird shit people buy during this time. Like there's some guy upstairs about like 100-inch television, and you see them, these guys in masks trying to bring this, probably what my, but there's a lot of stuff like that. And then also just the whole mask fetish, that people, which also serves absolutely no point at all. And if you don't have it, people get angry. People yell at me because I run along the river in the mornings, and people would scream at me. That they're kind of mellowing out a little more now, but like a week or 10 days ago, they would go totally ballistic,
New cases of COVID-19 have fallen in China in recent days. President Xi Jinping visited Wuhan, the epicenter, as a show of confidence that the Communist Party has the virus under control. Peter says you can see right on the ground the power of Xi Jinping's government.
There's a big sign in front of our building that actually has all the local government officials and their phone numbers and their pictures, which is a very unusual thing to have in China. Of course, I called, and then they, within minutes, set up an appointment, and I met the local party secretary. And so this is sort of unusually open in that sense. This is a little section of like a neighborhood of the city that has 6,000 residents. They've had one case, which is the guy in my building. But it's also just kind of an amazing, the violations of privacy, because in many places, like my students write about, like they will publish people's names who have it. you know, I mean, I've seen a few things I think very misguided where they talk about this as a threat to the party. I don't feel like that at all. I mean, I think this really reinforces their strength. I think it actually makes more people have faith in them.
And while the World Health Organization has praised China's efforts, these are measures that only a truly authoritarian regime can pull off, which has Peter a little concerned.
You know, I have like serious, you know, reservations about this kind of situation. Like, I think it's really bad that to shut things down in this way. You know, when you're building a society, it's not just about numbers on a death rate. To me, like, mental health is a big issue. And to me, like, being free from fear is a big part of that. I get in the elevator, and if people won't get in the elevator with me, first of all, and if they do, they turn their back to me often. And I think this is a psychological issue. I think it damages community. But all these things, it's not a body count, you know, and that's what you're up against on the other side, because they'll just say, well, you know, look at how the numbers went down in the quarantine. And those are people who are still alive, you know. And the thing is, there is everybody, you know, the public health people will tell you what's better to have an overreaction, underreaction. But I think there may be a point where that's not true. I think there is a more subtle way to do this, a longer term approach. You know, your quarantine and what they would call social distancing has to be more targeted to the groups that matter. You have to recognize that the disease sort of runs its course. And that there's probably not going to be a silver bullet for it. And also, like, eventually it comes back. Until you either have a vaccine or until you get herd immunity, this thing still is around. Like, because people have this idea that it's being defeated. You know, it's not like you do this and then it's done. It's going to come back.
Peter Hessler is a staff writer living under quarantine with his family right now in Chengdu. You can read Peter's reporting from China and more at newyorker.com. His recent book, which is about Egypt, is called The Buried. Now, for most of us, the speed and intensity of the pandemic came as an incredible shock, but maybe not for Lawrence Wright. Larry is a terrific journalist, the author of major books about Al-Qaeda and the Church of Scientology, among others. And he's been a staff writer since 1992. Larry has been imagining a virus like COVID-19, teasing out its consequences for a book that he's called The End of October. Now, this book is not journalism. The End of October is fiction, very much a thriller, but the circumstances certainly ring familiar. Larry, you're talking to me from a studio in Austin, Texas, where you've lived for a long time, and Austin is the home of South by Southwest, this huge music and film and technology festival, and was one of the first big events to be canceled. Tell me about the mood in Austin where coronavirus is concerned, and what does the cancellation mean for Austin?
Well, it's a $350 million loss to the economy, but that's just, you know, what would have been the spending. Everybody is very worried about the effect on the service industries, the restaurants, the hotels. There's so many, you know, gig workers who are just going to be flattened by this because so much of their yearly income depends on this couple of weeks of South By. My daughter used to rent out her house for South By and maybe Formula One, and it would pay her rent for the entire year.
Wow.
Well, that's not going to happen. And what's shocking to me, we haven't had a single case yet in Travis County that has been discovered, at least. But there's hardly any cars on the streets. I'm at the university. I only see a handful of students walking around. It's really quite striking, even in Austin.
So we imagine the impact of an outbreak like COVID-19. We think a lot about the immediate health effects, the people infected, the people who will recover, the number who don't. But your novel, and I should emphasize, it's a novel, not a book of science journalism, but we'll get to the research in a second. Your novel deals a lot with the unexpected ways that an outbreak can influence not just the public health, but culture and politics and economies. And are those second-order effects of a virus more dangerous than the virus itself? How would you equate that?
Well, they're certainly more enduring. You know, viruses come and sweep through a population. They may return, they may not. But, you know, like cholera, cities have been built, designed because of cholera, to have sanitation, clean water, clean air. All of that is because of cholera. Cholera is easily dealt with in the modern era, but the enduring effects of those cholera plagues is still with us.
The novel's about a virus of your own imagining. It's not about COVID-19. Tell me about the virus in your book.
Well, I call it the Congolese flu. I chose influenza as my medium because it is still the most dangerous virus that we're faced with. And I pictured it starting in Indonesia in a refugee camp. Indonesia has been persecuting homosexuals, and so I imagined that there was a camp, a detention center, where a number of people have HIV/AIDS, and their immune systems are compromised. And in that environment, a novel infection, a flu that has never been seen before, suddenly arises and takes root in the human population and becomes transmissible. And there is an attempt to quarantine the camp. But in the novel, the hero of the book goes to visit. His driver is contaminated and infected and goes to go on pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. And that's how the virus really gets ignited.
What's really uncanny, and again, emphasizing that it's a novel, is that the global political conditions are so much like what we have now. You've got United States and Russia are in conflict. Saudi Arabia and Iran are at each other's throats. The threat of climate change is everywhere. And there's a not terribly responsive president in the White House, though he doesn't go named.
Yeah.
What happens to that world when this virus is unleashed in it? And does it bear any resemblance to what you're seeing every day now in the news?
Oh, David, it's so demoralizing. Honestly, I read the paper and I feel like I'm reading another chapter of my own book. And I, unfortunately, real life seems to have taken the form of art and outraced even some of my imagination.
Well, how do you mean? What are you observing now in the reaction to this coronavirus that resembles what you might have anticipated, and how is it outstripping it?
Well, specifically quarantine. You know, quarantine is not a It's not a cure by any means. Its only goal really is to forestall the advance of a disease so that time can be used to develop some kind of vaccine or cure. And I imagined 3 million people in Mecca on Hajj and quarantining that. It seemed to me a real leap of imagination. It doesn't begin to compare with what China did, you know, 70 million people in Hubei province, you know, maybe 250 million people, 750 million people I read quarantined in one way or another. And now Italy, my own imagination would have balked at such a stupendous effort. I don't know what the world's going to be like when it's finally published in mid-April, and because this disease gallops along so much.
This isn't the first novel about an apocalyptic pandemic. Some in the past have had a pretty familiar form. There's a stable world. The virus throws that world into chaos. And then some brave souls defeat the virus and things go back to normal. That's not what happens in your book.
No.
Do those other novels get pandemics wrong somehow?
Well, you know, there are enduring consequences of any great pandemic, and they change the future course of human life. You know, smallpox, plague, you know, those great pandemics of the past are tremendous scars on history. They affected the outcome of wars. They affected the mortality of humanity for years to come. We tend to think after the 20th century, where there were so many triumphs of medicine, and we thought we had put the great plagues of the past to rest, excepting perhaps influenza. But then along came SARS, along came MERS, these other viruses that posed tremendous threats. Fortunately, we have been able to contain them somewhat, but they are incredibly dangerous.
Now, as you watch what's happening now, and obviously we're in early stages, how do you evaluate the American reaction to the pandemic on a government level?
Oh, God. Let's go back to, you know, when President Trump first came into office and fired the global pandemic team, including Admiral Timothy Weiner, who had handled the malaria outbreak in Africa and is credited with saving 6 million lives, and then cutting the budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention so that they were no longer able to monitor the health in most countries in the world. We were handicapped going out of the gate. You know, America is not a country like China that will easily lock up cities and partition states. So, you know, that's, you know, the trust is going to be that people will take care of themselves. But that's not really going to happen. I think that people will isolate themselves. There is social distancing. I think a lot of Americans are taking this very responsibly. But still, there's not going to be an absolute wall up the way that there is in China.
In a sense, what you're suggesting is that there is an innate advantage to an authoritarian state like China's over a democratic, fluid state like the United States in this kind of situation.
Here's what I think about China in that, you know, it's an authoritarian country. It does not like to have any criticism. It hides any kinds of interior problems it might have. As we saw at the beginning of this outbreak, where that young doctor made an outcry and he was suppressed, and of course he eventually died of COVID-19. Previously, you know, SARS had broken out in China, and China hid that. When World Health Organization authorities went to China to examine the situation, there were reports that the authorities had placed SARS patients in taxis and had them ride around until the WHO officials were gone. That is the downside of an authoritarian government. The other side of it is a government that is as authoritarian and brutal as the Chinese government can enforce a quarantine that I don't think any other country in the world would be able to attempt.
What was your first thought when you heard about this outbreak in China late last year? Did you immediately think we could end up where we are today? Did you expect a different outcome somehow?
David, good evidence is I didn't unload my stocks. I didn't take any of the precautions that a person, given all the knowledge that I had, should have done. Like so many people, I kept thinking, this isn't going to affect me. It won't reach my home. But I've been unnerved by it. I think it's going to be a real challenge to our democracy. And it's going to inflict a whole lot of grief on the world in one way or another.
When you say there's a threat to our democracy with COVID-19, what do you mean?
You know, let's start with just the difficulty of having politics in a place where people can't assemble. You know, what's going to happen with the conventions? How about voting? How are we going to manage those kinds of things? This is not a good time to be going out to mass rallies.
Larry, what concerns do you have for publishing a novel into the teeth of this? Are you
worried?
Yes, well, you're worried.
I don't know how people are going to react to it.
You're worried because what, or do you think it can provide information that's useful in a way that's maybe more easily or transmitted than, you know, a CDC announcement on television?
I think it'll make it understandable to people in a way that they couldn't maybe in another way. You know, there should be at least some hope from this novel in that there are these really ingenious, courageous people that are involved in fighting it. I went to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda and talked to, you know, immunologists at Pfizer, and I went to Fort Detrick where a lot of the biowarfare research had been done. And I was so struck by the ingenuity and the courage of people who work in public health. And that's why the book is dedicated to them. People actually go into those situations and confront these very cunning ways that nature has of sickening and killing us. That really impresses me. And I have a lot of confidence in them.
Larry Wright, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, David.
And best of health to your family and everyone you know.
And same to you and yours.
Lawrence Wright has been a staff writer since 1992. His book, The End of October, just to be clear, is a work of fiction. It's due to be published this spring. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Think a little bit about the family you grew up in. There's probably someone in there that you're a little, I don't know, ashamed of or afraid of. A sister who tells racist jokes, a brother who drinks too much and screams at the kids. An uncle who seems to have a little bit more money than anybody can account for. Every family's got someone. But I'm going to bet your family doesn't hold a candle to Astrid Holaders.
Most of the men that I know from my family are dead. I could name not many people that are still alive that I used to know because they were shot.
Holleder grew up in an Amsterdam neighborhood that's called Jordaan. It's gentrified now with galleries and Airbnbs, but when she grew up, it was big families in narrow apartments and a street life that was pretty unsavory. There was street crime, mobsters, and tax fraud. She grew up all around that stuff. But when Holleder was 17, her family would be at the center of a crime that became international news.
In Europe, the kidnappers of beer millionaire Freddie Heineken today made their first demand, silence from the police, Heineken's family, or else.
Heineken and his chauffeur were abducted last night as Heineken...
Almost four decades later, Astrid Holleder is still living in the aftermath of that crime. The New Yorker's Patrick Radden-Keefe wrote about Astrid and her family in 2018. When he went to meet her, he was picked up in a car and taken to a secret location. We've altered her voice in this recording because telling her story put her in great danger. Here's Patrick.
The kidnapping of Alfred Heineken, who everyone called Freddy, the magnate who ran the Heineken Company, one of the richest men in the Netherlands, was news throughout the world. Heineken walked out of his office one cold day, and as he was about to get in his car, masked gunmen pulled up in a minivan, grabbed Heineken and his chauffeur and drove off.
Freddy Heineken, hij is voorzitter van de raad van bestuur van de brouwerij, en zijn chauffeur zijn vanavond ontvoerd. Rond 7 uur zijn ze in het centrum van Amsterdam door onbekende gemaskerde mannen.
No one was more riveted by this crime than the Holleder family. Astrid actually remembers talking with her brother Willem, who was something of a local hoodlum himself.
I was sitting with him, eating with him, having dinner and telling him, well, who's going to kidnap Heineken? You must be crazy because this man is a friend of the royal family. He has like so much power. They will not get away from this. And I was telling him that. And he was like, oh, do you really think so? Do you think they can't get away with it? And I'm, yes, sure. Who could be so stupid?
The thing is that their father, Willem Sr., worked for Heineken.
He was driving the trucks with beers on it, like a beer glass of 3 feet high or something. So we grew up with Mr. Heineken. We grew up with the company. He admired him so much. He would do anything for him.
Their whole life was Heineken.
Like everything in our house was drenched with the company. We ate from plates from the company. We had pencils and pens from the company. We had like balloons from the company. We played with the balloons from the company. So he also enjoyed the beer of Mr. Heineken very, very much. My father was an alcoholic, but he was very cruel.
The violence in the neighborhood was nothing compared to what Astrid and her siblings were experiencing at home.
Coming home drunk, drinking all day, all night, and yelling at us up, beating my mother up. We never knew what to expect because there was no logic. It could just be because I put like my hand on the wrong side of the chair. That would be enough to receive a beating.
There were four of them. Astrid, who was fiercely independent. There was Sonia, who her mother described as a doll. She's very put together. There was their little brother, Erard, the baby of the family. And then there was Willem, the eldest, who, from his teens, started getting involved in the criminal world around him. He did this with his best friend, Cornelius van Hout, who everyone knew as Cor. They were really close. Cor actually started dating their sister, Sonia, when she was in her teens.
Well, Cor was like, he has what I call, and what we all lack in our family, he has joie de vivre. When things were bad, he would always see the bright side. Another thing that struck me is that he didn't seem to be afraid of my father. And that was something that I was impressed about.
Astrid admired Cor, and she liked him. And she identified with her brother Willem, the tough guy. She related to him.
I think that if I would have been a boy, then I probably would have been the right hand of my brother. Yes. Because I have the same anger inside me. I have the same aggression inside me. And I was very ambitious. And I think my brother is also very ambitious. And because I'm a girl, you could never take part of anything, to anything. So you were just a girl. And I had to look for other opportunities. His criminal career started with robberies. And those were like also spectacular robberies with speedboats and, you know, going through the canals of Amsterdam and then going through the water on the eye, the lake. And there were a huge amount of money that they laid their hands on, like millions.
But the kidnapping of Freddie Heineken was on a whole different level. It was so well executed that for weeks, the police had no idea where to look. Desperate, the Heineken family wound up paying a massive ransom, the equivalent of about $35 million today. Eventually, the police got a tip-off, and they found Heineken and his chauffeur. They were also tipped off that Cor and Wim were behind the operation. But when they went to Cor's house to arrest him, they found Astrid and Sonia there instead. The sisters were dumbfounded. They had had no idea.
I never expected him to have done that.
So you had no inkling. You didn't even have any sense at all that your brother, even you knew that he was involved in crime, but you didn't think he would do something like this.
No, no.
One of Astrid's biggest concerns when the police took her in for questioning was that she was going to miss her German exam. It just didn't compute for her, the idea that her own brother had kidnapped their father's boss. The Heineken kidnapping was kind of an ingenious plot. Cor and Wim had been planning with several associates for more than a year. They built a series of soundproofed cells hidden in a warehouse on the outskirts of Amsterdam. They devised a coded system for communicating with the police and the press. And by the time the police came, they'd already fled the country with millions of dollars in ransom money.
A lot of people commit crimes. I know, you know, it's something that happens. It's part of society. But it's never that close. And with Wim, everybody he has a connection to, he turns around and then he commits a crime towards them. And I think that started with Mr. Heineken.
Willem and Cor weren't at large for long. After a couple of months, they were captured in Paris at an apartment they were staying at in a posh area near the Champs-Élysées.
Het resultaat: Van Hout en Holleder krijgen van de Fransen huisarrest en slijten hun dagen in hotels. Daar ontvangen ze de pers en zo ziet Nederland voor.
They were arrested. There were so many questions unanswered.
Petter de Vries was a crime reporter for the Telegraph at the time, and he followed the whole thing very closely.
So I was anxious to know what happened, how they prepared everything, how they did it. And so I contacted Cor van Hout. I wanted to write a book inside the kitchen of the criminals from the point of view of the people who did it, the kidnappers.
Vim and Cor were giving interviews. They were stuck in a kind of legal limbo in France, and their fame started to grow. There were these young, cocksure, kind of arrogant guys from the streets of Amsterdam who'd had the nerve to kidnap the richest man in the country. They cut a dashing profile.
A lot of people were surprised that a criminal can also be a person with humor, common sense, and stuff like that.
Petter de Vries ended up writing this book called Kidnapping Mr. Heineken. It was a huge bestseller. This is the kind of book that people in Amsterdam who don't read books have read this book. Everybody knew the story of Cor and Vim. Cor and Vim were eventually extradited from France to the Netherlands, and they were tried and convicted and sentenced to 11 years in prison. But they ended up serving only 5. And when they got out, they were like celebrity criminals. Not only that, but the authorities had never been able to recover all of the ransom money. So with the help of some of their criminal associates, Vim and Cor had actually invested some of this money while they were in prison.
They bought real estate in the red light district in Amsterdam. So they bought all kinds of prostitution there. They bought like the gambling halls. They bought Casa Rosso. That's also gives live sexual live shows. The banana bar, it's a bar where women shoot bananas with their private parts. And that's where a lot of tourists come and watch. I mean, they bought it, yes. They had apartments, they had beautiful cars, not in their names, of course. It was all in names of other people, but they didn't have to work. It's not that you could see remorse or poverty or whatever. No, then the life started. The vacations, the house in Spain, all those kind of things.
Astrid remembers this as a relatively happy time. With their father long since out of the picture, Vim had assumed the role of the family patriarch. Cor and Vim were still partners in crime and best friends. Cor and Sonia had a second child. Astrid had gone to law school. So there was a kind of tentative harmony of the different elements in what was really a crime family.
Our families were always together. My sister had a house and we would all eat there. My brother, me, my other brother, my mother, Cor, you know. So we had one big family. And we thought everything went well.
After university, Astrid had tried to get a job in corporate law. But the Holleder name was notorious. When she went out for job interviews, nobody wanted to hire a Holleder. Vim suggested she meet with some of the criminal defense attorneys he knew. They were excited to talk with her. Being the sister of Willem Holleder had cachet. So she became a criminal lawyer. And it turned out she was really good at it.
I understood my clients. I understood the mothers. I understood the sisters that were arrested too, while they even didn't even know why. I understood the children. So to me, criminal law was, it was me.
As her career took off, Vim began to confide in Astrid. He would tell her about things he was doing, tell her about his fears. She wasn't formally his lawyer, but she did act as a kind of legal advisor, an informal sounding board.
So you, during this time, you had gone to law school. You had become quite a high-powered criminal attorney with connections throughout the city and the country. You're obviously a very formidable, smart personality. And yet you talk about kind of being under the thumb of your brother during this time. Looking back, like, how do you make sense of that?
First of all, I was his little sister. And in that sense, he was always older than I was. So he was always trying to be and remind me of the fact that he was older and I had to respect him. I was trying to give him the legal advice that would prohibit him from undertaking certain actions. Like when he was planning to shoot a rocket into somebody's house, I have to remind him that I think about him only, not about the victim he's planning to make. So that's why I advise him that he shouldn't do that, because if he would have used a rocket, that it would have been an enemy of the state. So I would advise him, don't do that, you know? But it was difficult. You don't want anybody to get hurt, but you also have to be careful not to get hurt yourself.
And it was all too easy to get hurt. One day in 1996, an assassin opened fire at Kaur as he sat in his car with his family right outside their home.
They were sitting in the car, and then a guy walked up to the car and shot through the window, and he hit Kaur. And my sister, she opened the door, rolled out of the car, and grabbed my nephew, who was sitting in the back singing a song at that time, and took him into the house. And Kaur was hit several times, but he survived.
Initially, there was just panic and confusion. When Kaur got out of the hospital, he and the family fled the country and went into hiding in a farmhouse in the woods in France. Vim promised he'd get to the bottom of things. After some investigation, he came back and he said, "I figured out who wants you dead. It's these two rival gangsters. They want to kill you, and they say that unless you pay them a huge sum of money, they're going to." This seemed believable. What was strange about it to Kaur was that Vim said, "I think you should just pay them." Kaur himself was no stranger to extortion, but generally he was the guy doing the extorting. So in this instance, he said, "I'm not going to be extorted. I'm not going to pay the money." And this was the beginning of a real wedge between the two friends.
And then it all started. Vim was trying to force me to tell him where Kaur was. And that went on for a long period. And that was really awful because it terrorized us.
Vim wouldn't let it go. He'd ask Astrid and Sonia for information about where Kaur was hiding, and they were reluctant to tell him. Over a period of time, an awful suspicion began to occur to the sisters. What if it hadn't been these gangsters who had ordered the killing?
Then in the end, there was a second attempt, and Kaur did survive again. And then there was a third time, and that was final.
After Kaur was killed, the family gathered together, and Vim came, and he comforted his sisters. But by this point, they were pretty certain that he was the man responsible for Kaur's death.
We were all three of us sitting on the couch, and he was in the middle, and he was grabbing us by the shoulders and pulling us towards him. And I'm like looking at my sister, and my sister's looking at me, knowing that this is all fake. And knowing you have to just undergo this, because if you do otherwise, you would accuse him. And if you would accuse him, then he would probably kill us too. So there was not much of a choice.
Just as Astrid was coming to realize what her brother was capable of, the rest of the country was falling for him. Vim started writing a column for a local newspaper. He was featured on a hip-hop single called "Villam Is Back." He even appeared on a national talk show called College Tour.
U bedankt voor het kijken thuis en Willem Holleder voor uw aanwezigheid hier in deze zaal. Dank u wel.
Bedankt.
Dank u wel.
People would see Willem around Amsterdam riding his scooter, and he became this well-known, kind of iconic figure. They started referring to him in the Dutch press as the cuddly criminal. People would come up to him on the street and ask for selfies. Meanwhile, his associates in the underworld started dying one by one. And with Kor dead, Astrid and Sonya were terrified for their children. Astrid's daughter, Milyushka, and Sonya's children, Francis and Richie.
It's always a question, is he going to do anything to the kids or not? We were two women with children and had to survive. So that's what we did. You feel hypocrite. From the day on that happened, it was a feeling as if I betrayed Kor, betrayed myself, because I just acted the way he wanted, not having the guts to go to the police or anything. So, that was the start of feeling dirty.
That's Astrid Holleder talking about her brother, Willem. We'll continue in a moment with this story from Patrick Radden Keefe. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We've been hearing the story of a woman named Astrid Holleder, whose brother was one of Europe's most notorious gangsters. The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe wrote about Astrid and her brother in a piece called Crime Family. Willem Holleder, Astrid calls him Vim, had served time for a notorious kidnapping, along with his friend Kor. But after the two were released from prison, there were multiple attempts on Kor's life, and he was eventually killed. More of Willem's associates started to disappear, and Astrid believed that her brother was now on a murderous rampage. However, accusing him was a risk she could not take.
It's always a question, is he going to do anything to the kids or not? We were two women with children, and had to survive. So that's what we did.
Our story first aired in 2018, and here is Patrick Radden Keefe.
No one was arrested in connection with Kor's death. Vim, for his part, was suspected pretty widely of involvement in a great many murders, but he was never charged. He could seem almost above the law, immune, zipping around on his scooter and palling around with local celebrities. But privately, he was becoming more erratic. Eventually, crime journalist Petter de Vries found himself in Vim's sights. Petter's popular book about the Heineken kidnapping, which was a big bestseller, had been picked up by an American production company.
That is the way the game is played.
You know how big this thing is.
He's insane. Or he's smart.
But before the movie came out, Holleder turned on him.
He said, I don't want to have my name mentioned in this picture. And at that time, he came to my house in the evening at 10 o'clock. And then the doorbell rang. And when I looked out of the window, I saw, hey, that's Willem Holleder. And I said to my wife, I don't think this is okay. He was on his motorbike. He had his helmet on. He had a big leather jacket on, gloves, big shoes. And he is quite an impressive guy, even without these clothes. And I immediately saw that he was fucked up. And he was, when I opened the door and I said, "Hey, Willem," he started yelling at me. And at that time, I was thinking, oh, in 30 seconds, I will be lying on the ground fighting for my life.
But Petter de Vries is a bit of a tough guy himself, and he's a seasoned crime reporter, so he managed to keep his wits about him.
I said, "Willem, calm down. Let's just talk. What's the problem?" And he finally calmed down a little bit, and he seemed to leave. And about three times he also returned to me, standing again very close to me. And, "Do I have to do it right now? You know what is going to happen. You can call the police, but it won't help you." And but finally, after three times, he went away, and that was it.
Petter did call the police. He filed a police report, but in the meantime, Astrid had started talking to the authorities too.
I couldn't live on with the thought that he would kill again. So that's when I turned on him. The only thing we would have left if we wouldn't go to police was take the rights into our own hand and shoot him. And I must say that would have been the best solution for him and for me. But my daughter didn't want me to. My daughter didn't want to have a mother, a killer for a mother.
She started to tell the police some of what she knew. But the whole process filled her with terror. What if Wim found out? What if she had to testify in court, but there wasn't enough evidence to send him away? She was a criminal defense attorney, remember. She knew what kind of evidence she would need. So she decided to wear a wire.
That in itself was a adventure, because at one point I thought I had a really good one, and I had it stuck between my the front of my bra. At one point, we were talking, and I felt that it was sliding. So I felt it fall down, and I was with him. So if it would fall on the ground, I mean, he would have noticed that. He would kill me immediately. So there were times that I was really, really afraid, and I kept on being afraid.
Astrid eventually compiled hundreds of hours of recordings. And she persuaded Sonia to record conversations with Wim also. The first time I heard these recordings, they gave me a shiver. You listen to them and you can hear, just in the tone of his voice, the kind of figure this guy was in his family. He was a figure of terror.
Mensen die dingen tegen mij gaan verklaren om mij van de straat af te halen. Jij bent alleen maar mijn stoorzender in mijn hele leven. Kangaroo, ik heb alleen ellende van je. Je familie van Cor, iedereen. Allemaal tegen me aan, door jou! Omdat ze denken dat ik erachter zit, kankeroer.
Willem was finally arrested in 2014 and charged with involvement in half a dozen murders, including the murder of Cor van Hout more than a decade earlier. Her brother is in police custody now, but Astrid isn't safe. In 2016, a gang member being held in the same prison told authorities that Willem had tried to hire him to murder Astrid, Sonia, and Petter de Vries.
What will you do in the admittedly very slim chance that he's not convicted?
Oh, then he would go after me and I would go after him. I'm not going to sit around and wait till he is killing everybody.
Astrid shuttles around the city in armored vehicles. She wears disguises and she lives in a series of safe houses. When I went to see her, I would be told to wait by a particular canal in Amsterdam, and a driver would show up, then take me to an undisclosed location. I never knew where I was going. It was never to her apartment.
I'm living in places that are furnished. It's always being in somebody else's house. So that's different. I'm like 52, and I don't really have a place of my own.
When she testifies in Wim's trial, she sits behind a screen. She doesn't want anybody to see her. But also, the prosecutors don't want her to be able to see Wim. So she's behind the screen, yet her voice fills the courtroom. And the two of them bicker and argue. They shout at each other at times. It's incredibly tense. If Willem is convicted, he'll probably be held in a maximum security prison until he dies. But even then, Astrid won't feel safe. I asked her why, and she said that if he gets a life sentence, her brother will have nothing to think about for the rest of his life but revenge. Like Willem, Astrid has become a celebrity in the Netherlands. She wrote a book called Judas about how she turned him in. Think about that title. She doesn't see herself as a hero for stopping this murder spree. She sees herself as Willem's betrayer.
I think it's awful what I do to him because he will be in prison for life. So thinking about that, being the person that sends him away for life, that's an agony every day. If I think about the moment he must have heard that I was the one who testified against him, that must have been such a shock. And later on, he did say in court how it felt for him to hear about us, especially me, testifying against him. Yeah.
Watching the trial, what struck me the most was that despite the incredibly raw conflict between these two siblings, as brother and sister, they still share a powerful bond. That having grown up in this abusive environment, Astrid feels, despite it all, incredibly connected with her brother.
I keep thinking about all the factors of our childhood. I'm like, well, it could have been me, you know, if I would have been a boy. It could have been me.
If you could talk to your brother, if it were just the two of you today, now, together, not in the courtroom, what would you say to him?
Oh. Whoa. That I still love him in spite of everything. That I wish I could take him home. That he could be a brother to me. And, that I could take him home.
Astrid Holleder, talking with The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe in 2018. Willem Holleder was found guilty on multiple counts of murder, and he's now serving a life sentence. You can find Patrick's article, Crime Family, at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. You can find much more of The New Yorker Radio Hour by subscribing to our podcast. Thanks for joining us. Be well, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.